Hello, everybody. Or I just turned the heat up a little bit. Felt a little bit chilly in here. How are you doing? Did you see the beaver?
No.
Not that easy.
You still haven't seen any work.
I'm not even sure how many there are. I've only seen one very fat beaver sitting on the ice who immediately dove in. But you can see that they are, I'm tithing. They're up to about 1/10 of my trees.
What are you talking about?
The beaver eating my trees?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them? Did you see those dams? They're welcome to a certain number. The others have fences around them. So to pick up for a bit the themes of this morning about time and lunar time, I did a little quick poke around about calendars. And you know, calendars exist for fairly obvious reasons. To agree on future events, you know, and record events. The word comes from calling the new moon. Who gets to call the, who's first one to see it, right? Who gets to call the first moon? you know, a time of settling accounts from ancient time. You know, even back then you had to pay your bills on the first. apparently a 7-day week is practically universal. And I think that's because, you know, the cycle of the moon is 29 1/4 days. So, you know, that's your nearest good division. And I didn't realize that the calendars fall into two sort of major categories. There are astronomical calendars, and those are based on ongoing observation. You know, somebody needs to be really watching the celestial happenings. Are you guys involved with that at all? And that's been going on kind of forever. And then there are ones that are arithmetic-based, based on a strict set of rules, a calculus, so that trying to get it to fit, trying to get it to fit our notion of a year and still have months. And so there have been various kinds of solutions to that. There's even now something called Lunar Standard Time. Have you heard of that? Well, it's a time reckoning designed to be used by future moon colonists. They've already tried to make a calendar, and we're not even there yet. That's a little scary. The earliest lunar calendar was maybe from Scotland in 8000 BC, or in the cave at Lascaux. That would be 17,000 years old. There's some debate about that, whether that was really a calendar. But, you know, that's a pretty long time ago to be making a calendar. The length of a moon cycle actually varies a little bit. You all probably knew that. I was kind of vaguely aware of it. But it's not exactly the same each month. And I don't know why. But so even if you're using a lunar calendar, there's still calculations that are needed. So if you have a lunisolar calendar, sort of trying to harmonize the cycles of sun and moon, you end up with leap months. And there are calendars like that for sure. And you can either go with the tropics and go by and have seasons, or you can go with which constellation the full moon will be close to. And then, of course, our Gregorian calendar is solar. And here's a little comment on that. This is from Jim Harrison. On my newly devised calendar, there are only 3 days a month. All the rest is space, so that night and day don't feel uncomfortable within my confines. I'm not pushing them around, making them do this and that. Oh. I kind of like that commentary on a calendar. But, you know, we certainly recognize cycles. And so I think I mentioned this morning this fellow Hoffman, who gave a talk that was really interesting to me, not easy, but interesting, in which he put forth the argument that time and space do not have a reality, that they are constructions. Humans have made in order to be able to get along and stay alive. And but he ends up saying, I am interacting with some reality, but it is totally different than space and time and red tomatoes. And then he walks right off a limb and says, well, my fellow researcher and I think it's an other consciousness. But, oh well, you know. <It's> like, but I thought it was brave of him to say so in the scientific context where he was. So, you know, our we make not one but many constructs about time, don't we? And they are helpful until they aren't, which is really partly what the Lankavatara keeps talking to us about. You know, they're helpful in keeping us alive, but what if our staying alive actually also depends on having a relationship with things, a deeper relationship with things, a relationship with the stuff we can't know, right? Having a relationship with the part of it that's invisible to us. And, or visible to us, but we just don't know what to make of it, so we make something of it. But if we have a relationship like the relationship each of us would like people to have with us, which is not to think they've got us all figured out. You know, isn't that one of the most irritating things? When somebody thinks they've got you all figured out. So maybe the world's like that too, you know? Maybe we're irritating when we act like we've got it all figured out, but intimate when we don't. You know, when we're curious, when we are open to, God forbid, mistaken perceptions. And so, so our practice, I think, is actually very practical when it comes to space and time and things and each other and ourselves. Practical in that it lets us find a different relationship with reality. And I hope that you could feel bits of that, little waves of that, or an undercurrent, really, is what it more often feels like to me, an undercurrent of that in meditation when we get still and quiet. We're so used to giving our attention to the biggest, brightest thing in the field. Our thoughts, our worries, our emotions, our memories, our projections forward, all of that, you know? And yet, the biggest, brightest thing in the field is usually a very small portion of the field. And when we're in meditation, when we open our breath, why? When we let our attention be unbounded, or focus it deeply until it kind of empties itself out, which is not to say no thoughts, it's just to say that the attention itself starts to feel so deep that it doesn't have content. When we do that, then I think we are practicing being a good friend. You know, we're practicing not operating from our assumptions, but actually looking this in the eye. You know, listening intently with a bent head, you know. And this is a quote, but I don't think it was Hoffman. We put our entire being on the ground of true reality of all beings. I think this is Dogen. Yeah. Instead of the picture of the world that is a creation of our minds. I'll say that again. We put our entire being, remember, it's not all happening in here. And in fact, Hoffman says, you think your brain causes something? There's absolutely no evidence that your brain actually causes something. And my brother, who's a neurobiologist, agrees. We know a whole lot about what every cell does, but we don't know how you see. We put our entire being on the ground of true reality of all beings, on the level ground where we can meet everything on equal terms. Instead of the picture of the world that is a creation of our minds. Now, for those who are reading the Lankavatara, it would say, what mind is it a creation of? Because your mind is a fiction too, as a separate thing, but creation of mind. And he goes on to say, this is the basis of the precepts. So even though it's not the full direction we've been going today, I wanted to bring that in because we really work with our precepts and we try not to take the precepts as one more matrix to lay on top of everything, right? One more way to slice and dice our reality. That's really not what we think our vows are in this tradition. But instead, this openness to, connectedness to a reality that's mysterious to us and hard to see, out of that comes our awareness of impermanence, because it only takes maybe, 3 minutes of meditation before you notice that things don't hold still? And no self. Likewise, it doesn't take too long in meditation if you're willing to inquire to discover that you cannot find a me in there. You can look, and you can have sort of stories about, on the concrete level, right here, baby, born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I could give you the whole story, but I won't, so be thankful. but that really, when I look in to try to find that self, there it's not there. And that all of us, as we're saying all the time, are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving goes on without end while each thing stands in its own place. Our meditation is so powerful because you don't have to be good at it. You don't even have to do it that long. You don't have to have a great teacher, thank goodness. You don't have to be a great student. It will show up. These are not doctrine. These are the things that show up when you let them. Yeah? When you relax your grip on what you think is reality. So then the precepts just grow out of that sense of this is how things are. So this is what will work best. This is what will be harmful. This is what won't be harmful. And Dogen describes this also as a different relationship with time. A different relationship with time, where we are not so insistent that the continuous flow of events is an external time. The continuing flow of events is our experience, and we call it time. And we also find this realization in other places, in poetry, in Annie Dillard, that we read this afternoon, right? And she talks about time, did you notice? among other things. And in this Celtic, C is only supposed to say S before an E. It's a rule. I'm sticking to it. The Celtic otherworld, where things are glimpsed, you know, as if only by peripheral vision, right? And it's a world where you allow that imagination may not be self-deceit, that it may be glimpses of other possibilities. So that in dream and in daydreaming and in listening to music and in those other times when your guard is down, you can know, and in meditation, when hopefully your guard is down, you can notice the creativity of what appears, and you can wonder, where did that come from? And if we're willing, we can notice that there are many, many possibilities of appearance of this world, and that the more of them we're open to, the more possibilities we have. Yeah? And so the reason that I'm harping on that is that, you know, Dogen thinks it's important enough to be the basis of the precepts. And many of you have heard or read Bernie Glassman saying the fundamental basis of the precepts is not knowing. Yeah? Is I'm not certain. I do not have this figured out. So there are a couple of spots in Dogen's The Time Being that I thought were especially lovely examples of that. This one, the way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. All of this that is the way the self arrays itself, right? Pine trees, magpies, beavers, is the way ourselves array ourselves. See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. What if we don't have to be the keepers of things? What if we can allow that this phenomenon, this experience, this which is whole and indivisible, this moment, is us? And that we don't have to know every little particular thing about it, and we can't. But we can receive it gratefully, yeah. As Dogen says, at the end of our precepts, we just accept it gratefully, yeah, with respect. We just accept it with respect and gratitude, yeah. And, you know, I think we think that's so hard, but just because we have a habit of not doing that, logically, does not have to mean that it's very hard, does it? We have lots of habits of doing things that turn out not to be very hard not to do. Right? Like, you know, not flossing your teeth, you know? It's actually not that hard to floss your teeth. Get some argument there. But you do you see take my point that we maybe could see each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. What if it's oh Jen, we need your sign. This isn't so hard. Jen has a wonderful koan quote that she made a sign out of that says, "This isn't so hard." So, you know, not a bad mantra, right? What if we could allow the possibility? You don't have to believe it. Anyway, he goes on. Things do not hinder one another, just as moments do not hinder one another. The way-seeking mind arises in this moment. A way-seeking moment arises in this mind. It is the same with practice and with attaining the way. Thus, the self, setting itself out in array, sees itself. This is not easy stuff, in case you didn't notice. This is the understanding that the self is time. So that you are time. And then there was another really lovely one. This is not easy either, but let it just let it go through you. Do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. Right? We can follow his logic that far. That, like that duck, right? There's a koan about ducks flying away. The teacher says, or the student says, "Where did they go?" And the teacher says, and the student says, "Ow!" The teacher says, "See, they didn't go anywhere." So that's this, right? If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is that you think of time only as passing. And think about that. If you think of it only as passing, you got nothing. Right? In essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being. Maybe that's enough of that. Except the last line of the next one I liked was, so-and-so-and-so-and-so, our time, practice enlightenment is time. Being splattered with mud and getting wet with water is also time. Okay. So I don't know what time it is. Apologies if I'm going on too long. What time is it?
4:32.
Okay, this next part is short. I started to think about making a talk, and I just had this rebellion going on, and you know, the kind where, no, I can't, I won't, it won't do any good, you know, all that stuff. And so I let my pencil just run away with me for a little while, and I thought, okay, I'm going to bring this, because not because it's good, but because this is what my pencil decided to do. According to the calendar, there isn't very much time. You can see how quickly each box gets crossed off? You better move faster. You better be smarter about all the things that must be done. You better make better choices. According to Pooh and Piglet, this might be a good time to go see Eeyore. According to the moon, there's no time at all. When she's daring, she'll be bigger tomorrow. One evening soon, she'll be all round, deliciously round. And then she'll be a little flattened on one side, her face looking wistful, maybe. And then she'll be coy, slipping off to the side of herself, slim. And none of this has anything to do with time. She's just like this, and then this. And you are it, this moon, and this moon filling a particular universe of you without you having to make anything happen at all. That's why she has nothing to do with time and everything to do with your life. And then different thing. I decided to read poetry instead of scripture. I decided to watch a cop show instead of the news. I decided to say the words that happened instead of the right ones. I decided to listen only to the spaces between, the spaces where the music lives, where my heart breathes. The gardens were very pretty, but the tangled bushes down by the creek banks are home. One night I ate half a head of cauliflower. True story. No symphony of color on my plate. It was fascinating, all the different tastes of white. And slowly the world befriended me. Now I had come home to it. "We've missed you," it said. "Come on in."